Last time, someone mentioned Teilhard de Chardin. And I thought about that afterwards, and I thought that if there's someone here who is familiar with Teilhard, Father Teilhard, and who would like to prepare a presentation for this group at some point when you feel like it's relevant, this would be very welcome. I can always pull out references now and then, but I think that Father Teilhard is one of those few people so far who has actually tried to create a philosophy of evolution. Sri Aurobindo has done that, and it looked for a while like Rupert Sheldrake might be on the way. So anyway, we want to try to do philosophy here. We want to engage ourselves in the philosophical process and create a philosophy of evolution, if we can do that. And that is, as we said last time, primarily a process of assembling, gathering, understanding. If you're not a naturalist, and therefore by nature immersed in the processes of nature, then it's important to put yourself in touch with that consciousness in order to understand something about evolution. How many people here, or are there any people here, who are naturalists? If you need to ask that question...
I was a teacher of science, so to what degree, what chemistry, I taught...
Okay. Are you familiar at all with the notion of multiple intelligence? It's a school of cognitive psychology which has successfully identified 8 approaches to knowledge that are endemic. That is to say, there are people who develop one or the other of these 8 approaches quite prominently, and it's across the human species, and it is a phenomenon that is related to brain development. And so just as there are subspecies or varieties of butterflies, there are also varieties of human beings. And one of those, which is very, very prominent and easily recognized, is called the naturalist intelligence. And this is the person who spontaneously, effortlessly notices incremental differences among plants, trees, animals, behaviors. And it's not just the green thumb, but it is a cognitive faculty which makes it very easy for you to categorize, to understand lineages, and not to be satisfied in your knowledge of nature without knowing the categorizations of all of that which you see and which you cannot help but appreciate and love and be overwhelmed by constantly. And so you have to put some order into all of that. And then you begin to be one of those people who really understands nature. And if you're ever with a person like that, walking about in nature, they will observe 100 things in the period of time that it takes you to ask a question about one thing. So, Charles Darwin was one of those people. And when you read his writing, you have to be amazed at the extraordinary breadth and depth of observations that he makes. And because of that, he was able to write The Origin of Species. There were a few other people around in those days who were talking about the same principles and writing about them. And in the introduction to The Origin of Species, there's a historical chapter in which he mentions a dozen other people at the time in the first part of the 19th century who were making similar observations and giving papers and so on. So there was a group of people at that time who were making the same observations. And Wallace, of course, the Origin of Species theory is attributed to both Darwin and Wallace, but there were many others. So he in this history, he remarks that in June 1859, Professor Huxley, that's T.H. Huxley, gave a lecture before the Royal Institution on the persistent types of animal life. Persistent types of animal life. Referring to such cases, he remarks, quote, "It is difficult to comprehend the meaning of such facts as these if we suppose that each species of animal and plant, or each great type of organization, was formed and placed upon the surface of the globe at long intervals by a distinct act of creative power." Difficult to understand how the idea of individual acts of creation, that's what they call it, which at that time were commonly thought, even by naturalists, to be the origin of species. Individual acts of creative power. And so throughout this treatise, Darwin often concludes a passage by saying, it would be very difficult to explain this series of complex interrelations by the theory of individual creation. And his arguments are very convincing. So we will come across some of those. I want to enable us to hear firsthand some of the passages that are very clear definitions of the theory of evolutionary descent by variation and natural selection. That's Darwin's theory. So, it was obviously a very compelling idea among philosophers and scientists in the mid-19th century that what we observe in nature in terms of lasting groups species and genera, was apparently a natural, the result of a natural process. It was a phenomenon of nature. And it was a very compelling need that they had at that time to distinguish that idea from the idea that species were a product of individual creation by a power other than a natural power, by a divine power. So they were obsessed with two things: making very clear the processes of nature on the one hand, and defending themselves and arguing persuasively for the sake of culture and education and importance and value against the religious idea that species were created by a divine power outside of nature. They were obsessed with this idea. So in an early chapter, the chapter called Natural Selection, chapter 4, Darwin says, "Let it be borne in mind how infinitely complex and close-fitting are the mutual relations of all organic beings to each other and to their physical conditions of life. And consequently, what infinitely varied diversities of structure might be of use to each being under changing conditions of life. Can it then be thought improbable, seeing that variations useful to man have undoubtedly occurred, that other variations useful in some way to each being in the great and complex battle of life should occur in the course of many successive generations? Can it be thought improbable that useful variations have occurred in life, in species, through many successive generations? Because we know that man has, by breeding, created useful variations. If such do occur, can we doubt, remembering that many more individuals are born than can possibly survive, that individuals having any advantage, however slight, over others, would have the best chance of surviving and of procreating their kind? Is that clear? If useful variations do occur, can we doubt, remembering that many more individuals are born than could possibly survive, that individuals having any advantage, however slight, over others, would have the best chance of surviving and of producing, reproducing their kind? This is a kind of logic. If you have an advantage over others, however slight, and if many more are born than can possibly survive under natural conditions, then doesn't it stand to reason that those with the slight advantage will be the ones who do survive? under changing conditions of life. On the other hand, we may feel sure that any variation in the least degree injurious would be rigidly destroyed. Any plant or animal born with a serious defect, along with another plant or animal next to it with no defects, is probably going to be eliminated in the struggle for survival. We should feel sure about that. There should be no doubt about that. This preservation of favorable individual differences and variations and the destruction of those which are injurious, I have called natural selection. To the creature itself.
So are you going to question natural selection?
Pardon me?
Are you going to question natural selection? It's interesting in terms of human society.
Very.
Yeah, because one of the things that, one of many things that sets us apart is that some aspects of society choose not to, or will not want to destroy the ones that are defective. And that is one of the things that sets us apart.
Therefore, we have overpopulation. Serious overpopulation. So, we'll definitely pursue that idea. We'll definitely pursue that idea. And this is actually the whole purpose of entertaining close theoretical understanding of nature, because we are part of it, and yet we have the freedom to act outside of many of the patterns that we recognize in nature, and we don't have the power to act outside of some of those patterns. And yet, yeah. So we're, and then, you know, there are the extreme optimists. Anyway, that's the theory of natural selection. And then he says, variations, neither useful nor injurious, would not be affected by natural selection and would be left either a fluctuating element, as perhaps we see in certain polymorphic species with different forms but which don't necessarily have an advantage or a disadvantage, or such sort of neutral variations would ultimately become fixed, owing to the nature of the organism and the nature of the conditions.
Further development of this
what is the factors in it?
Darwin says, several writers have misapprehended or objected to the term natural selection. Some have even imagined that natural selection induces variability, whereas it implies only the preservation of such variations as arise and are beneficial to the being under the conditions of life. No one objects to agriculturists speaking of the potent effects of man's selection. And in this case, the individual differences given by nature, which man for some reasons selects, must of necessity first occur. Others have objected that the term selection implies conscious choice in the animals which become modified. And it has even been urged that as plants have no volition, natural selection is not applicable to them. Volition means will. And so some have thought, he says, that natural selection means that plants and animals choose the variations, or at least that Darwin was trying to imply that that there was some element of choice in the theory of natural selection. And he insists that that is not the case. It has been said that I speak of natural selection as an active power or deity. But who objects to an author speaking of the attraction of gravity as ruling the movements of the planets? Who objects to that metaphor? Everyone knows what is meant and is implied by such metaphorical expressions. And they are almost necessary for brevity. And I would say almost necessary for communication. Metaphor is our most useful form of communication. So again, it is difficult to avoid personifying the word nature. Nature does this. Nature does that. Nature is a being. But I mean by nature only the aggregate action and product of many natural laws. And by laws, I mean the sequence of events as ascertained by us. The sequence of events as ascertained, perceived, and understood by us, human beings, especially naturalists, because not everyone can perceive a relationship between cause and effect in nature.
Consists of this many movements which are irrelevant to this one movement of going ahead of time, this intelligent desire, as if it doesn't exist, as if. And what Darwin did in his definition is very interesting. He made a double reflection. First, he speaks about that they follow the nature, and by nature I mean the laws, but by laws I mean that we are ourselves doing the thing. So basically, by this double reflection, there is an impression of something meaningful and explaining something. There is not much explained.
Nature, if I may be allowed to personify the natural preservation or survival of the fittest, cares nothing for appearances, except insofar as they are useful to anything. She can act on every internal organ, on every shade of constitutional difference, on the whole machinery of life. Man selects only for his own good, nature only for that of the being which she tends. It will come to us in a beautiful vision. Next paragraph. It may metaphorically be said that natural selection is daily and hourly scrutinizing throughout the world the slightest variations, rejecting those that are bad, not useful, preserving and adding up all that are good, useful for survival and procreation. That's what he means. Silently and insensibly working whenever and wherever opportunity offers, and opportunity is variation, at the improvement of each organic being in relation to its organic and inorganic conditions of life. We see nothing of these slow changes in progress. Until the hand of time has marked the lapse of ages, and then, so imperfect is our view into long past geological ages, that we see only that the forms of life are now different from what they formerly were.
Basically, it's an excuse of some kind. Since we don't see this huge span of time, we don't see this intelligent design, and we excuse ourselves of saying what he said. Finally, we see something. We do not have the depth to see how nature works. That's why we do not have access to it, but this is the fact. The fact is that she is working, but how she is working and why she is working, we leave it in the
past. I see we have an advocate for intelligent design in our midst.
For anyone who may be interested in seeing these changes that Darwin is talking about in a rather short time, there is a book which I think is in our library called The Beak of the Finch.
I have a copy of it.
And I'm sure you've been, perhaps.
Yeah, it's a very readable, contemporary study of finches who vary quite rapidly under changing conditions of life. So one of the subjects that Darwin deals with at length is the causes of variation. And I'm going to pursue that next time at some length. Because he defines, first he says, the causes of variation are infinitely complex and largely unknown to us. But at the same time, he defines many likely causes of variation. And one of his discussions is about this idea of the increase of species under natural conditions, where he quotes from Linnaeus about the geometrical increase of species under natural conditions, and the idea that it's impossible that all of the products of life could survive if all the progeny of all of the animals and insects survived. This would be an unmanageable situation. And then he has a chapter on checks to increase. So some of the checks to increase that he notices are that among egg-laying species, many eggs are eaten before they hatch. Among seeding plants, many seeds are eaten before they are able to emerge, bud. But in the process, many are also moved by birds to other locations. And so there is at the same time the process of spreading, which adds to diversity, as there is the process of devouring, which limits the number. He mentions the seedlings being stifled by weeds, by insects, and by grazing. And he describes beautifully examples of each one. And it isn't at all boring to read his descriptions. They flow very mellifluously. He's a pretty good writer. He mentions limitations of the food supply, which occur sometimes because of weather changes and sometimes because of deforestation, which is happening right now. And in the last 30 years, about 25% of vertebrate species have become extinct in just 30 years on Earth, the past 30 years. 25% of vertebrate species have become extinct, mostly due to habitat destruction. Now global warming is coming in behind human habitat destruction, and many more are becoming extinct because the food cycle is being interrupted by global warming, weather change. So climate change is another factor that he mentions in controlling increase of species, of individuals. Epidemics, prey, being preyed upon. And the combination of climate change and competition for food, he identifies as being a very important factor in selection, because variations do occur that allow species to adapt to both climate change and competition. And so there's a complex that can be observed at work in nature quite easily and often. Yeah, I'll bring a whole chart for classification. You'll also find it in the handout that I gave. And yeah, we can discuss that a little bit. I think, though, right now, just there's not much time left. I want to point to one philosophical aspect of this discussion, and that is the tendency, which was very prevalent at that time, and which is still prevalent today, to think that species are unchanging, that they're fixed, that they were created once and for all. And this is our normal experience. And in fact, Teilhard de Chardin starts one of his books with this problem. In a period of 300 or 500 or so years, if we look at paintings and drawings and if we observe nature around us, we actually see, unless we're naturalists, pretty much the same species there all the time. And so in history, before science began to observe very closely, and especially if we go back to the origins of science in the Greek period, it was universally accepted that species were eternal. And so this idea that that species are created, not that they evolve, but that they are created, is largely a product of sequences ascertained by us. But now that we have scientific techniques, and our scientific techniques pass from generation to generation, those sequences that are ascertained by us include the genome itself and the whole fossil record. That fossil record was not available to Darwin, and there are many sections in here where he raises the question of the possible challenges to his theory on the basis of the fact that there are great lapses in the fossil record. There are far fewer lapses in the fossil record today than there were at that time. So at that time, because Lyell, who was a cousin of Darwin, was just discovering earth changes and geological time, and it was just beginning to be understood that geological time was beyond conception, basically. The same kinds of excavations that were enabling us to understand geological time were also turning up more and more fossils. And so the fossil record was ample enough that naturalists could easily see the recurrence of body plans over long periods of time. And they could see that the horse had evolved. They could see that the pig had evolved. They could see that birds had evolved. And so at the same time, they were breeding. But one of the things that you'll notice in this handout from Haeckel, and that you'll also notice in Darwin, is that they use the term strong inheritance. They know that generations inherit variations, but they don't know how it works. And so they refer to inheritance as a strong factor in the process of natural selection. But nobody has studied Mendel yet. Mendelian genetics hasn't been studied by these guys yet. They're basing everything on naturalistic observation. So they're traveling around the world, seeing different species in different islands, related to species on the mainland, and they're looking at fossils, and they are inferring the process of the connectedness through time of species, and they're inferring the process of variation under different conditions, and they are attributing the connectedness to inheritance, and they're attributing the selection process to natural conditions that make some variations more favorable than others, and so far they don't know anything about genetic mutation. So this whole theory, which was in fact substantiated by genetics in the 30s and 40s, was being based solely on naturalistic observation. Similarly, in Aristotle's time, and Aristotle wrote the Organum, you know, he wrote a philosophy of taxonomy and relatedness of species, and that's all based upon, he was a naturalist, by the way, and a very good one. Aristotle, yes, he was one of those geniuses known as naturalists who observed everything in nature and retained it all. And so he wrote the first taxonomy, and so we're going to discuss his theory of evolution a little bit. But it was entirely determined by the perception that species are eternal. That's the only evidence he had to go on. And so he came up with the philosophy of forms. And I'll give you something to think about at home. Aristotle. Aristotle defined four causes. And whether you read today Whitehead or Heidegger or Dennett and Dawkins or Sheldrake or anybody who's thinking philosophically about evolution, you will find a reference to this theory of Aristotle. Aristotle said that there are four causes of any phenomenon. There is the material cause, there is the efficient cause, there is the formal cause, and there is the final cause. So Aristotle would say that the material makeup of something determines a lot of what happens to it. The matter of something, you know, the matter of the human being is different from the matter of the snail, and that's different from the matter of the geranium, and that's different from the matter of the volcano. So there are material causes. The efficient cause is what comes from outside and moves it over to this place where it gets hotter, or what moves it over to this place where it gets colder, or you know, what do you do to the plant to preserve it so that it grows fully and realizes itself? What do you do to the child who you're teaching? These are the external causes of a change. And then there are the formal causes, and that's what we were just talking about, the species. You are not going to become an elephant, and an elephant is not going to grow until they reach the moon, and things are limited by their type. So a bird will build a nest, lay eggs, bring food to the birds in the nest, take care of them until they can fly. This is the form of the bird. The bird knows how to do this because of the form. And that form is thought to be eternal. And Aristotle learned this from Plato. Then the final cause is, guess what? Anybody know what the final cause is of the bird doing what I just described?
Final aim?
Survival, reproduction. Darwin. What's the final cause of educating the child?
They can surf the internet.
To take over.
Consciousness.
knowledge,
growing consciousness,
skill,
the continuation.
It should be red.
It should be orange. This is the final cause. Everything moves towards the good that attracts it, and that good is eternal, infinite, true, beautiful, powerful, otherwise known as the supermind. And in Sri Aurobindo's writings, you find many cross-references between his conception of the overmind and supermind and Plato's conception of these things. So things don't just have one cause, they have four. Yes?
Are there examples of the naturalist mind in Indian shastras?
There are definitely examples in science. Birds, for example, Ralph Ali's father, grandfather, who was the great ornithologist, and who could recognize any bird at 100 meters.
I was thinking more of back in the chapter writing.
Yeah, probably, but I don't know.
In very simple words, good. It conjures all the things.
Right. And so...
It implies that there's a move away from the bad, and there's a sort of mystic thing of being born and evil and then having to be wrong. It kind of brings in a whole set of things.
Yeah, and this question is definitely a philosophical question. And, you know, Darwin speaks about extinctions and destructions as being part of the process of evolution, just as much a part of the process as of evolution as variation and selection, you know. And Sri Aurobindo speaks of nature's harsh economy. And we all know that in the ignorance, the spur to progress is pain. So these dualities, has anyone here read my paper called Physics and the Philosophy of Evolution yet? Which I passed out last week and which is on the website? It's about that question to a large extent. And I propose a concept for dealing with that and other similar dualities. And at some point we should discuss that quite in depth. But first we need to have some material. So we are just collecting material right now in the form of great ideas, systematic thinking, some reflections on the principles both of nature as it's being observed and the mind observing it. In that little other introduction that I passed out, for philosophy, these are two very important questions. What is the world that we observe and that we're a part of?
And what is the consciousness that's observing it? And how does that consciousness know whether what it's picking up is what's really there? So there are solutions to these questions. There are answers to these questions that I'm convinced are quite finite and important. And I hope we come to them as a process, you know, as a result of the process. I mean, one can always put up a chart and say it's this and that, but it's the important thing is to recognize the aporias, the questions, the enigmas, and the lapses in our own ability to put together all the pieces. So whenever a question arises in your mind, that's your hook, that's your connection. Follow it. And all the different cat types,
yeah,
which cannot,
yeah,
mate, are belong to a common genera.
Yeah.
And it's true that biologically there are several other qualifiers for a species, but it finally, in most cases, not in all, but in most cases, they cannot interbreed, however similar they may be in other ways, but not in all cases. And so it's not an absolute criterion, but it is pretty much the final test. Sometimes when they breed, when they interbreed, they produce sterile offspring, which means that they can interbreed, but they produce sterile offspring. But the sterile offspring sometimes become capable of reproducing later. And so there's a continuum, and it is possible to isolate patterns within the continuum which are consistent for a certain period of time, and then eventually they all change. And so the great Darwinist of the day, who just recently died, Ernst Mayr, is very fond of pointing out that 99% of all species that have ever existed are now extinct. We don't perceive that. That is the result of careful study over a long period of time. I mean, a relatively long period of time. 100 years or so. Okay. Good night.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.